Oil exports stopped in Ecuador after days of protests that began on August 15, 2005, in the oil-producing provinces of Sucumbíos and Orellana. Local government officials, along with people in the region, blocked highways, took over oil wells and airports. Protesters demanded more oil wealth be invested into the area. Oil sales account for a quarter of Ecuador's GDP. However, many in the provinces of Sucumbíos and Orellana do not have access to potable water. There are few paved roads and plenty of electricity shortages. Activists also demanded that the oil industry reverse environmental damages caused in the area. Najat Drost, an activist and filmmaker, recently completed a documentary about the effects a new pipeline, the OCP, is having on the people of the Amazon in Ecuador. I spoke with her about the oil industry in Ecuador on August 22, 2005. Give us an introduction to the OCP. What is the OCP and why was this pipeline built?
Sure. Well, the OCP is a consortium of seven oil companies, and the OCP in Spanish stands for Oleoducto de Crudos Pesados, which means heavy crude pipeline. And the reason it was built primarily was to increase the amount of oil that Ecuador was capable of exporting. And in fact, to the extent that oil production in Ecuador would actually have to double in order to fill this pipeline. And it was financed largely by the oil companies themselves, as well as foreign banks. And the oil companies involved range from American companies to European companies, and the largest shareholder in this project is actually a Canadian company based out of Calgary called Encana. And they were largely seen as the one of the main proponents of this project because they wanted to increase production in their oil fields in the Amazon and wanted to ensure that there was a way to actually transport that oil from the Amazon across the Andes to the ocean, to the Pacific. And one of the, I guess, the most kind of contentious issues regarding the construction of this new pipeline is that its route very closely parallels the route of an already existing national pipeline called the SOTE. And over the past 30 years of the SOTE's operation, the SOTE has ruptured and leaked about double the amount of oil that the Exxon Valdez did. And part of the reason for that is because of the actual geography that any pipeline is going to have to traverse if it wants to cross Ecuador, because it has to cross the Andes mountain range. So the OCP's route, for example, crosses 94 seismic fault lines, and it passes by six very active volcanoes. So there's a whole range of concerns, and one of them being the route was based on, you know, the negative experience of all these oil spills in the past. And that's, of course, of concern to the oil companies also, because they don't want to have, you know, leaks and ruptures that's going to result in them losing the oil. So it was a major undertaking that cost over $1 billion and took a couple of years to construct.
Can you talk about the environmental and the social impacts this pipeline has had on the people of the Amazon?
Sure. Well, I think the impacts are kind of twofold in terms of the geographic impacts. The pipeline starts in the Amazon, but most of the pipeline actually traverses from the western part of the Amazon across the Andes and then down to the Pacific. So the actual pipeline doesn't affect that much of the Amazon itself. But where the Amazon will be greatly affected is because of the future significance and impact that the pipeline has already started having. And that is that in order to fill the pipeline, as I mentioned, Ecuador is going to have to actually double its oil exports. And that's going to necessitate an opening up of about 2.4 million hectares of rainforest for oil production. And when that happens, that's going to greatly impact on indigenous groups, many of whom are vehemently opposed to oil development because of the past 30 years of experience. And so obviously you can imagine the environmental impacts that opening up pristine rainforest to the oil industry will have, but there's also a lot of social impacts, and those are most acutely felt by indigenous groups who find that their traditional ways of life are very much disrupted when there is a kind of flood of newcomers to their communities to work in the oil industry. And unfortunately, what's happened in Ecuador is what some people have actually termed as genocide, because certain indigenous groups have pretty much been decimated, and their populations are very, very small. They've had to confront diseases that they never have before, which have very much impacted them. And they've also been introduced to new phenomena such as alcoholism and prostitution. And there's been a lot of social disruption within the communities. And one of the strongest social impacts, which is one that is really hard to measure, it's not really quantifiable, but it's that of social divisions. And often when an oil company wants to exploit oil from an indigenous territory, they will try to build relationships with certain community leaders. And what ends up happening is that communities are pitted against each other, and leaders are pitted against each other, those who are pro-oil and those who are against oil. And so a lot of internal conflicts result from that, and that is one of the strongest impacts that oil can have at a social level. And in terms of the environment, in terms of the pipeline itself, I can talk about the impacts of oil production itself, but in regards to the pipeline, what a lot of farmers found along the route was that their land was basically being destroyed in order to dig this pipeline. It's a buried pipeline, and their land was not fully restored to the condition that it was prior. The oil consortium, the OCP, had made promises that it would replant the vegetation to the exact same condition, and that simply didn't happen in many cases. So a lot of these farmers who are, you know, very poor, based on our standards to begin with, have found themselves in a situation where they have a tract of their land, which is often a very sizable portion of their total land, is completely unusable. Perhaps it used to be pasture for cattle, or they raised crops on it, and they simply can't use it anymore. And of course, there's no compensation for the years of loss of productivity on that land, although there were farmers who were compensated to a certain degree for the disruption of having it constructed on their land in the first place, but there were many, many farmers who never were. So that's been a very contentious issue, that a lot of farmers never wanted this pipeline going through their land, but found that when they protested, their land was expropriated.
Could you tell us some of the stories that people told you when you were making your film about the oil industry or the building of the pipeline?
Sure, they were really, really powerful stories, and what struck me so often was the bravery and the courage and the resistance that a lot of these landowners put up in the face of, you know, very powerful forces, of a very powerful oil consortium, a powerful police force and military. And I heard basically the same story, but different variations, very many times. And what often would happen is that a landowner would be approached by a community relations personnel of the company to say, listen, you know, can you sign this piece of paper here that says that you're going to allow us to dig this pipeline on your property? And certain farmers would sign away. Sometimes they would be offered what was often very minimal amounts of money, and others pushed to have greater compensation, something that was fair, and they were often met with great resistance. Then there were other farmers who outrightly said, we don't want this pipeline coming through our land. And what would happen to them is that they would often receive threats from the company personnel, saying, well, you know what's going to happen to you if you don't sign this piece of paper. And then the next thing you know is they have anywhere from 20 to 80 military come onto their land. Now, the oil consortium had actually hired a division of Ecuador's national police to protect their pipeline. So the oil consortium made use of those police as well as the Ecuadorian military to basically coerce peasants into giving away their, not giving away their land, forever and ever, but allowing their land to be used for the digging of this pipeline. And often, as I said, that land was no longer usable by farmers. So there were a lot of people who were assaulted by police and military. There were people who were thrown into jail, arrested multiple times often, and yet they kept on resisting because they saw that this was a project that was basically going to benefit a certain part of the Ecuadorian government, that was going to benefit foreign oil companies, and it wasn't going to benefit them. And their stories were very remarkable in the sense that they had so little with which to resist, but at the same time they often did so on an individual level or at a community level. There was several communities that I spoke with who every single morning when the construction of this pipeline was to begin and all the machines were getting revved up, they would actually arrive at the construction scene at about 4 or 5 in the morning to stake their ground, in a sense. And they managed to completely halt the construction of a $1.4 billion project for weeks on end. And they were able to find out, where every single point of construction was going to be for the next week, and they would be there at the ready, preventing the machinery from going through. And they did that in solidarity with each other. So, all the farmers would get together to protect one farmer's land for a day, for example. And then if the machinery was going to be at a different farmer's land, that's where they would go the next day. And they managed to hold on to that for several weeks until the military pressure grew too much and cleared them out and made several arrests. So those are some of the types of stories that I would hear from, one end of the pipeline to the other.
One of the demands of the recent protest in Ecuador is to have more oil wealth be invested into the area. Could you explain why this is an important demand?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, Ecuador has this really sad history in the sense that it's counted on oil production as its main source of revenue for over 30 years now, yet it doesn't actually seem to have helped out the Ecuadorian economy whatsoever, and Ecuador's economy seems to be, spiraling into this eternal crisis as a result of what many people think is oil production itself. And right now, about half of oil revenues, actually more than that, go towards paying off Ecuador's national debt, its foreign debt. And so there's very little of the revenues to actually trickle down to the population. The money that is left in Ecuador is often, it goes to line the coffers of Ecuadorian politicians, unfortunately. And so there's very little that is spent on infrastructure projects, on social and health and education projects. And very little of that is actually diverted to the Amazon region, which is the region that is the country's oil producer. And the Amazon is one of the poorest areas in Ecuador, ironically, even though the country relies on that region for its main source of revenue. So I think that right now, in terms of what's happening in the Amazon and the protests that are occurring, the frustration is not new. The fact that this area and towns in that area still lack electricity, running water, paved roads, proper health and education programs, that's been going on for decades, unfortunately. However, the frustration is not going to stop as long as the country decides to run its oil production and exports in the same way that it has been, and as long as it's not actually funneling some of those revenues back into the region that is so oil rich.
I want to now talk about Canada. You were earlier talking about one of the major stockholders in the OCP was a Canadian company called Encana. Can you talk about your own campaigns against Encana and the company itself?
Sure. Well, I started running a campaign on Encana several years ago when I first started getting reports from Ecuador about this new controversial pipeline and the fact that a Canadian company was at the head of it. And so what I did was work with a lot of Ecuadorian grassroots and national organizations who were working on oil issues, working in resistance to the pipeline and to many of these foreign oil companies such as Encana. And I really wanted to make Canadians aware of the link between, you know, what happens when we go to a gas station here in Canada. Do we actually think about what kind of impact our oil consumption is having in very faraway places on the earth, and what kind of impact our own Canadian companies are having in you know, a lot of countries around the world? So the campaign consisted of reaching out to the Canadian public, especially through the media, informing the media of what was happening in Ecuador in relationship to Encana and this OCP pipeline. And the campaign also focused on the investment side, so trying to raise awareness amongst Encana's investors about where their investment was going. And there's a kind of growing sector of investors known as social or ethical investors, and a lot of people these days are choosing to better watch where their investments are going and would rather invest with a socially or ethically responsible investment company. And so this, by alerting the social investment community about what Encana was doing in Ecuador, eventually got them blacklisted from those social investment lists. And that's fairly important for a company who has a reputation as large as Encana does, and for a company who especially wants to be seen as very environmentally responsible and socially responsible. So I found that was one of the kind of more promising routes to go on in terms of trying to address some of these issues through the people who are actually funding this company or making recommendations on investing in this company. And so part of the campaign also meant showing up at shareholder meetings and questioning Encana's management about their operations in Ecuador, bringing Ecuadorians here to Canada to do public speaking events, to attend the shareholders meeting and speak about their experiences at the hands of this company. So those are some of the things that I was involved in when campaigning against Encana, and that was the main reason why I decided to do a film, actually, was because I thought that a film would basically be one of the most effective ways to get this story across to Canadians.
Do you think it is possible for an oil company like Encana to be a responsible company?
Well, I think that it's definitely possible to be more responsible. I think that if you make a decision to go into a certain area that is particularly volatile in terms of social unrest or politically volatile and environmentally sensitive, it really reduces the ability to act responsibly. And in the case of Encana in Ecuador, given the Amazonian ecosystem and how vulnerable it is to the environmental impacts of oil production, I think it is extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, for a company to conduct themselves in an environmentally responsible way. There are definitely cleaner technologies that they can use, but given the environmental impact that's inevitable and the social impact that it's inevitable, I don't think it's actually possible to explore and produce oil in a completely responsible way. And I think that an oil company has to make a choice from the onset. If we're not able to do this responsibly, are we going to go into the area at all? In the case of Ecuador, Encana is operating in a national park. Encana is operating in a UNESCO World Biosphere Reserve. So those are questions where I think a company has to ask, well, if we actually want to be a strong actor in terms of environmental and social responsibility, there are certain zones where we simply should not go. And sometimes that's the most responsible decision to make. Building a pipeline over a mountain range like the Andes, over 94 seismic fault lines, that's bound to have impacts. I mean, we can't stop earthquakes from happening. So there are certain areas in the world that are more safe to operate in, and Ecuador's Amazon, unfortunately, is not one of them. So I think that no matter how good intentions Encana might have now or in the future, I don't think that it will ever be possible for them to be completely responsible, although there are ways that they definitely could be more responsible. So it's just kind of, I think there's a definite margin for improvement, but I don't think it's possible to be 100% responsible.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Nadja Drost.
Thank you, Christine. Likewise.
That was an interview with Nadja Drost, activist and first-time filmmaker, about the oil industry in Ecuador. Thank you.